Hi there. Before we begin, let me explain something. This 12-part series was made at WYSO, a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO's staff and infrastructure to get the job done. We'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.
Hi, and welcome back. This is episode 8 of The Ohio Country, called The Removals. I'm Chris Welter.
You may never have heard this tragic story, even if you grew up in Ohio. In 1830, President Andrew Jackson pushed the Indian Removal Act through Congress, which resulted in the chaotic and deadly forced removal of thousands of people in the state of Ohio. I'm Nina Ellis.
Stay with us. From public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, you're listening to The Ohio Country.
After the death of Tecumseh, which marked the last concerted efforts by Ohio tribes to stop American expansion through military resistance, there was a period of growth and change in the state of Ohio. Still more settlers and immigrants came and bought the land newly available to them. But at this time, the tribes were presented with a series of questions. Should they try to live side by side with Americans as neighbors? Should they leave for lands further west? Shift from female-controlled agriculture to male-controlled agriculture, as Christian missionaries promoted? There was no clear right choice, as the United States government pushed for the complete removal of tribal nations from Ohio. One tribe that was flourishing before removal were the Wyandots. They'd been in Michigan and the Ohio country for more than 100 years and held thousands of acres of land in north-central Ohio. Their headquarters was at Upper Sandusky. This is Chief Billy Friend, chief of the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma and a United Methodist pastor.
We were known as the keepers of the council fire. We were known by the Delawares and some of the other tribes as the grandfather because we were one of the older tribes. And of course, in Upper Sandusky, especially once the Methodists came, you know, and began to help educate our people, you know, we became farmers. In fact, most all the ground when we left there, there was homes with farms that were fenced and cultivated. And we had two of our tribal chiefs at that time became ordained Methodist ministers. We had two of our gentlemen that had became admitted to the bar, became attorneys in Ohio. One of our citizens was the postmaster of Upper Sandusky. And so we really don't like to say we became assimilated. We became acculturated, you know, that our people believed that if they could take on enough of the white culture, that we'd be allowed to stay.
But acculturation wasn't enough to protect the Wyandot from American settlers. And they were the last tribe to be forcibly removed from the state in the 1840s. A local newspaper called the Western Christian Advocate described the harassment the Wyandot endured from white settlers. The paper called the settlers lawless villains. It said the Wyandot's horses have been stolen without redress, their property injured, and their persons insulted in almost every way. The situation was becoming untenable, and the Wyandot were forced to relocate.
When the Wyandot walked, they had horses and cattle and their wagons and everything they could possibly carry loaded onto those wagons and onto their horses. And they walked 150 miles from Upper Sandusky here to Cincinnati. Throngs of people lined the street to watch the last tribe leave.
Dr. Rebecca Wingo. We spoke to her in episode 1. She has an ongoing partnership with the Wyandot Nation to better commemorate their history in the state, which could result in historical markers on the Cincinnati waterfront to describe the disturbing scene at their departure.
So even when you read the newspaper accounts, which are loaded with bias, they describe it as an inevitability. And so people are flooding the streets to see the last Indians in Ohio. That's what they call it. All of these newspaper articles are called the last Indians. So many people were lining the streets that the Wyandotte couldn't even get through to the steamboats. They had to put police and guards on the riverbanks to keep people from walking onto the boat to see them leave, to just see, to touch, to understand, and to lament. And they were really of these two minds. They were like, this is very sad. This is the end of the race. But there was nothing to be done about it.
Yeah.
This is manifest destiny. It's literally people believing that they have a right to be here and others do not. And I can't even imagine what that would have looked like to the Wyandotte folks who were leaving their homelands and headed to the unknown.
So why did this happen? If so many people were so sad to see the tribes leave, if there was opposition to the removals, why did it happen? It was federal politics, says Dr. Mary Stockwell in her book about the Ohio removals called The Other Trail of Tears. It happened because of President Andrew Jackson. If you know anything about the forced relocation of the Native tribes of North America, you probably know about the Trail of Tears, the removal of tribes from the southeastern United States, especially the Cherokee. Stockwell says it was central to Jackson's campaign for office.
So Andrew Jackson becomes president in 1828. He was sworn in 1829. He has been open about it throughout the entire campaign. We're going to have removal. We will offer tribes in the east land across the Mississippi. We'll exchange it. It's voluntary. Mm. Voluntary, that's what he said. He also said, if you want to stay here and be American citizens, he allowed that for some of the Cherokee, but he said, if you want to maintain your separate nations with different laws, you cannot do it within the confines of the United States. He was strangely a supreme nationalist. And so he said, if you want to retain your identity, then you must cross and leave this country and go out across the Mississippi River. And he was adamant on it. It was a horrible fight in this House and the Senate. People living in Ohio should be proud of the fact that our senators fought him every step of the way. Every congressional district that had an Indian reserve in it, and they're all in Northwest Ohio, they voted against Andrew Jackson on this, mm-hmm. even if they're in Jackson's party. He only had support down in the Southwest Cincinnati area. They are wildly Jacksonian. They would not, you know, give it up. Jackson could also say, because he was speaking to small farmers and he was speaking to immigrants, when this land is surrendered, I'm opening this great country up to you guys. Mm-hmm. And so his political supporters were small people, not a lot of wealth. And he said, the country's going to be yours. You get this black soil. You get the woods. You get everything. Indians will be okay. They'll be out across the Mississippi River.
And so, after Congress passed the Removal Act of 1830, one by one, treaties were made with the tribes describing the terms of their removal, including where they would go, how much land they would get, and how they would travel. The U.S. government put infrastructure in place to implement the moves, hired people to oversee the removals, and called them conductors.
They hire conductors, they hire doctors. They are under strict orders to write down absolutely everything that happened. That's why we know what happened. Mm-hmm. It's sitting in the archives in the Library of Congress. It's stunning, the records we have.
And so the tribes leave, the Shawnee, Ottawa, and Seneca Cayuga, who were all living near Wapakoneta. They left as a group, about 800 people all together, in the fall of 1832. The wagon trains pulled out of Ohio, heading west. It's October, and the weakness of the infrastructure soon became a crisis. President Andrew Jackson had refused to pay more than $20 per person in expenses for the trip, and in less than 100 miles, the wagon train was out of money. Along the route, people died in the chaos. There was a cholera outbreak in Illinois, and while they did make it to their destination in so-called Indian Territory in Kansas, the removal was devastating for the tribes.
And many conductors, when they got back east, would say, I can't believe we did this. I can't believe that we forced them. If we did, why didn't we pick good weather? Why didn't we go in the summertime? Why were we always leaving in the fall? And in the winter, it was disorderly. It was an absolute mess. It was a huge endeavor that the U.S. government didn't think through. Those senators and congressmen were backing Jackson. They weren't thinking through implementation, which is what I guess what I discovered. My God, what chaos.
You're listening to The Ohio Country from public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. This is Episode 8, The Removals. Laura Day is a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. She lives near Seattle. She's a teacher and an award-winning poet. About 20 years ago, she came to Ohio for the first time on a bus trip organized by the tribe and Chief Glenna Wallace to visit places the Shawnee people once knew well.
She has also read first-person accounts of the Shawnee removals kept by the people who were overseeing them. And she also knows the Shawnee stories passed along to her and her tribe's oral tradition. And the result is an award-winning poetry collection called Tributaries, published in 2015. It describes the removals in an intimate way. We see and hear and smell the land and the wildlife. We meet mothers and their newborns, families caring for their elders, too. We also meet gawkers and Indian agents. We see starvation, illness, and constant danger as the families endured a 600-mile trip to the land they had never seen. Laura Day grew up in the Pacific Northwest, in the Snoqualmie Valley of Washington State, where she spent a lot of time on horseback, and she says she grew up knowing that she was Shawnee.
I'm just going to say hello to you as I would in Shawnee, and I'll tell you the word for the season that we're in. I'll do that because I think it's always wonderful that people who are in Shawnee territory can hear our language. So the way that I would say hello if we were together, I would say hoes kisiki, haka hoes las mamowe. Laura Day Nitesitho. And in Shawnee, our greeting verb is to breathe. So what we ask each other is, how are you breathing? Which I think is quite beautiful. And I know it's a beautiful, beautiful time of year here in the Pacific Northwest, but also quite beautiful in Ohio. So Takwaki is the season that we're in, the fall season in Shawnee language.
It seems to me that you have been aware since you were a child of your tribe's history and story, including the removals from Ohio. And it seems like you were aware that that story was either not being told or often told incorrectly.
I was really fortunate to grow up with a strong sense of myself as a Shawnee person. So I have to offer some gratitude to my folks and my ancestors for maintaining that deep connection to the tribe. So as long as I can remember, I have known that I am an Indigenous person, that I'm a Shawnee person. I do think that that sense of erasure or the idea of how a removal sort of echoes across the generations, that came to me very young. I think it came to me so young that I can't even quite remember when I started to think about that. But I think it's important that that knowledge and that quest to better understand our homeland, it did come in the context of being with my tribe. So the first time that I went back to Ohio, for example, was with other members of the Eastern Shawnee tribe. We went back to kind of understand and see our homelands. So this difficult journey of better understanding that removal is not one that I had to take alone. It's one that I took in the context of my tribe.
You are able to put together a narrative within this book called Tributaries. This narrative of the removal told through a character named Lazarus Shale. Tell us who Lazarus Shale was. Was he a real person?
The figure of Lazarus Shale is not actually, it's not a true person. And I'll give a little bit of cultural context to this. I always want to be respectful of Shawnee tradition when I'm writing about Shawnee history. So one of the things that we tend to avoid is we don't really name folks who have passed. So I wouldn't have named an ancestor just out of respect for that tradition. And instead, I did a lot of research. I really purposefully elevated oral tradition, so family stories. And in my mind, I sort of created this composite, this person or this perhaps symbolic figure who would have been a child. And I had become a mother. And one of the things that came to me just from that kind of human point of knowledge was so many of the Shawnee folks who were removed were very elderly folks, women and children, young people, because the cyclical kind of wars of attrition created that community. So I really thought about what would it have been like to have been a mother on this removal, and what would it have been like to have been a child and have this shape your worldview. So that's one of, I think, the entry points to the book for me was the true kind of human experience that I was going through as a parent led me to this sense that I wanted to perceive this the way that a mother and child might. And so you wouldn't find a Lazarus Shale in the historical record, but I did utilize, you know, the name Lazarus. I think the symbolism of the name was important to me, but it was also a name that was commonly given to Shawnee children, kind of superimposed over their Shawnee names. And so that sort of symbolic figure I think of as the guide through this book and through this movement through history. And I feel very connected to the figure of Lazarus Shale, even though, as I say, really it's sort of a historical composite more than a real person.
He feels like a real person. He does. Could you read the first part of this series? It's called Five Songs for Lazarus Shale.
Yes. The context would be that Lazarus is in his home Shawnee village, which might have been the village of Wapakoneta or Hog Creek. And this is in the moments just before and during the processing of the Indian Removal Act. So this could be anywhere between, you know, maybe 1829 and 1832 were the years that that act began to be put into place. And it does begin with a quote, so I'll read that as well. Five Songs for Lazarus Shale. It gives me pleasure to announce to Congress that the benevolent policy of the government, steadily pursued for nearly 30 years, in relation to the removal of the Indians beyond the white settlement, is approaching to a happy consummation. President Andrew Jackson, 1830. 1. There was a word for village that meant all at once, perfect home, perfect man, all human systems working in harmony. A Shawnee village was a good genius society. Names were to be guarded. First memory, clambering onto a horse, toes splayed for purchase, peering over the swayed back at a curving glimmer of tributaries, listing rows of corn as far as the eyes could travel. 2. Running on spindly legs and speaking in a bubbling rush of Shawnee, the boy fled through cane breaks when the Indian agent called. A child's arrow tipped with a gar's fin pointed to the eddy. In the wilted moon, the Quakers gave him the name, Bible held hovering out of reach, as he grasped at the inked picture of a man shouldering out of a stone tomb. The agent sat in the back pew, sniffing the end of a quill, a slim flask of ink between his knees, wet trail on the ledger, Lazarus Shale. 3. Tawny coffee beans, bolts of calico, molasses, rations passed out the back door. Speculation at the trading post on the topic of removal. Lewistown first, then Lima Village, Hog Creek, on down the curve of the river to Wapakoneta. Sat moon cold. Traders walking foundered horses over coals, anticipating army requisitions. Lazarus tracing letters in the ash. His aunt stitching rounded meadow flowers onto doe skin. Pumpkin yellow, greasy blue and green, white heart red beads. The baby waking every so often to press a few grains into her chubby fingertips. Tallow flicker across their mother. Why, sister, you're beating in the old style. In the rafters, her fingers turning back to unbraiding, the family's dried corn falling in dusty ropes. 4. Journeying cake. In the morning, Quakers press wrapped suppers into their hands, reading from the Book of Ruth over the noise of the muster. Generic native ash cake baked in an open fire. Dig under the crust to find the varieties of corn in the charred fields of Wapakoneta, Dent, Flint, Boone County White, Bloody Butcher. Journeying cake, Shawnee cake, or everyman's cake becoming Johnny or Johnny cake. Walking away south along the Scioto, looking back often. Vivid shoots of green corn rippling along the trail in a delicate commotion. Fingers bent against the leather satchel, pinching at grains of cornbread. Lazarus, who else could tell this story? 5. In Shawnee tradition, one is cautioned to cross a river quickly without looking down to tempt swift creatures, ready to rend the body in riparian embrace. Underwater panthers. Left to ponder such beings, the mind balks. Mad River, Scioto, Great and Little Miami. Shawnee translations of the rivers of Wapakoneta, Auglaize River, the falling timbers on the river, Blanchard's Ford of the Auglaize, claws in the water.
Lazarus and his family leave. They leave their village. They're going west. The second poem in this series describes their actual leaving Ohio. And it starts with an epigraph. Can you read that?
Yes. So I'll read the epigraph from this poem, which is called Hived Bees in Winter. This epigraph comes from something called a Journal of Occurrences. So because removal was a military act of war, journals of occurrences were kept by the agents and military members who forced these removals. And this quote does come from the Journal of Occurrences that pertains to the Shawnee removal. The Indians, as yesterday, remained as quiet as hived bees in the winter. Daniel R. Dunhue, Superintendent of Indian Removal, Journal of Occurrences, 1832. 1. Plum moon heat, deep and pungent. The Wapakoneta band of Shawnee muster in a grove to wait for 4 days' rations. In the periphery, the horizon is a memory palace. A verse is woven into the curve of the river. Hiding in a fringed prairie opening is an account of the maiden who fell in love with the loon. Driven slowly into the west, the old folks walk cowed bending low into the corn. Three men petition for permission to make camp beside hunched burial mounds along the Scioto. The superintendent of Indian Affairs acquiesces. I did intend going tonight to the Feast of the Indians, Death Feast. Upon leaving the graves, an orator laments. It is their custom to recite and mutually and undisquietly express their sorrow for their losses. The superintendent is startled awake by a stray horse trailing a rawhide hobble. The heat is gentle yet. A line of women are sitting on the wagon and chanting. Under their draped legs are sleeping children. In the miles that follow, a singer prods the corners of his mouth, scanning the horizon for a forgotten refrain.
Before we go to part two, I just want to ask you a question about something here that is just so powerful for me. It says, in the periphery, the horizon is a memory palace. And I had to look up and remind myself what memory palace meant. It reminded me of how these stories were passed along, right? Because there were visual associations made with events to the visual environment. And that's how things were remembered. That's how things were solidified in the group memory. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, and that's a very important insight to the poem, and I think it's an important insight to the worldview of how significant removal is when a culture is intrinsically connected to the land. So for Shawnee people, the land is a living connection, and it's not something that you can extract from, and it's not decontextualized. So one city is not the same as another. And just as you said, I think one of the points that I wanted to make is that our oral traditions were connected to the land itself. So the land was a memory palace. It was a recollection, a living story that storytellers would tap into at different seasons and times to kind of tell the story of who we were. And with that removal, that loss is really profound. We continue, of course, to have rich oral traditions. They never left us. But the loss of that memory palace is something that perhaps doesn't immediately occur to a person in terms of the loss of being removed violently from land. But I think it has a lot of implications as to why it matters so much. That people are connected to the land that they live on.
I interrupted you. Let's go on to part two.
Okay, two. South of Fort Wayne, wilted moon sweats the Maumee River. A woman wakes the camp, shaking and clattering her arms together. Wet cough like a bare foot sucked out of deep mud. Young ones scour the fields for corn cobs, lingering after the harvest. Their bones recognize the chill is different, punctuated one night by a prairie fire, wafting on tall grass and crackling to the east. Waxed comb dragged through hair, heavy with the smell of bear grease and honey, crackle and snap as lice and eggs are lathed onto a whetstone and flicked into the fire. The horses scrape lichen from tree trunks, grow surly and thin, foundered in trail sludge. Lazarus is lolling along the back of one, palms down on its shaggy neck to soak up the warmth. The superintendent calls a halt at the intersection of the St. Joseph's, St. Mary's, and the Maumee, and ponders the flooded rivers from early morning to mid-afternoon. Militia men place bets and aim at a sleeping turtle on the opposite bank. Fording in the early evening, They cross through raised cornfields and march down the portage road to the Wabash Agency. Gawkers spread around, shivering in the muddy space between the quartermaster's shack and the kitchen garden. A man in a waxed brown cape darts in and out of the crowd, flashing a flask and sloshing whiskey in a bottle. Lazarus buries his face into his cousin's tunic. With two fingers, the man twists his chin back out into the gloaming.
Can I jump in here? This is so ominous, this scene of this man darting in and out in the brown cape with the whiskey and the gawkers around. It feels so frightening to me.
Yeah, I think this was a dark section to write. One of the things that alarms me, even as I read it now, is there is probably a child experiencing an event like this right now. And one of the things that I think I wanted to really focus on in this section of the poem was how devastating it is to keep a family safe without the context of a home and a community, and how incredibly vulnerable people were made when they were removed and when they were militarized, how hungry they were, how cold, how the children were very difficult to protect from the inherent predators all around. And it's important to note that part of the American story is one of this profound cruelty of watching this abject suffering. So I think that this section is, to me, one of the most difficult to get through, but one of the most historically honest as well.
There's a part three.
December's moon is eccentric, January's severe. Clean geometry of trumpeter swans stitching a slab of sky. Snuffling bear on the edge of the encampment, nosing for a cache of acorns. Lazarus has been chewing the horse's oats, nibbling the trampled grass, dusty tang of urine and hint of molasses on his molars. The flock of swans lights down, and in their churning multitude, they melt a frozen pond to sleet. Giddy with hunger, he grasps at their necks, knee-deep in icy water. In the early dawn, small imp, Lazarus crouches beside an old man, seated on a tree branch, downwind of the hunt, so they must squint to see. The hunter hides in a hollow log with a leg of rancid deer, drawing the bear deeper and deeper in. Another man squats above, waiting at the knothole to drive an arrow deep into the bear's head. Sated, Lazarus rubs oil into his hair, shakes his limbs, huffing like a bear in the snow, pausing dizzy as he hears a hollow whicker. The mare's time has come. Creekside, groaning softly as her knees buckle, white pills of lather foam in the pockets of her flanks. The foal slips neatly in an envelope of mucus, and the mare turns to nip the cord and consume the waxy placenta. A man aprons a ration of oats, strokes the mare's neck in circular motions, and beckons to Lazarus. Run your hands all over the colt. Trace every part of him. Lazarus, he'll always be fond of your touch. 4. At the waxing of the crow moon, the most skilled midwife died coughing. There an open prairie, no fluttering branches or creek bank caress. So the girl whimpers in the corner of the tent and turns her face into its dank scent. Women pull her closer to the brazier. Her dress rucks up around her hips, sharp lavender tributaries of veins standing out across her thighs and belly. This is her first, so she writhes when she should rest and begs for her mother in fitful starts. Fingers dipped in grease move nimbly between her legs. She is cajoled, oiled slick, cradled and lullabied. In frustration, one woman slaps her hands together and speaks sternly to her. When she finally tears, the babies seem to hurtle out, one on the other's heels. She reclines on her elbows as the women caress their small mouths to her nipples. The people sit around the fire. Children are allowed to stay up and meagerly gorge on dried strips of dark venison, bear, and swan in honor of the propitious birth of twins. Mama, what is he saying? Lazarus is lolling with his back against his mama's legs as the headman drones on. He reminds us, in the old times, babble of the smallest children was most auspicious.
Let's move ahead to Kansas now. They traveled from Ohio, across Indiana, Illinois, across the state of Missouri into Kansas, and this was called, am I right, it was called Indian Territory?
Yes, so this was the original first stop of removal. So our tribe is now in Oklahoma, but originally our removal was to Kansas.
Yeah. Poor Lazarus. Have you read that one next?
Of course. Poor Lazarus. Live long enough, and salt pork, beans, yearling colts, honey and butter, something will turn into a wedge to bend your will. Missionaries call for my sons to send off to school. Each season, when the corn is green, I tuck them into the rows, farthest to the north of my cabin, keep them busy with the threshing as I whisper their true names into the ears we consume. But I leave a path to them, like a snake, by slithering away through the sparse harvest. Frost breaks under my mare's hooves when I ride to sign my name at the Neosho Mission, my sons and nephews, traded to industrial school in the north for the release of 7 barrels of winter rations. This commerce makes me brother to dragons, companion to owls. Riding away from the mission, I call to my sister's youngest child, the only one still too young for school. Come over here and ride with your old uncle. The boy clambers up behind me, bare toe notched into the girth for warmth and purchase. My boots quiver along the sides of the horse's flanks as I endeavor to slip them into the stirrups that frame the ground below in jerky patches. Child, I keep repeating, nephew. The horse dances nervously, sensing my frenzy. To his credit, the boy keeps a steady hand on the reins.
Lazarus is really feeling pained by what he's had to do to survive. The last poem in this series tells another really difficult story, but I think it's important to end with it. So let's hear Lazarus riding home.
Lazarus riding home. Skin for skin, my senses know. The lanky liver chestnut canter song, scattering pebbles in front of my cabin. And before I see the Indian agent from Neosho looming beside my corn, my ears wince. Old panic to have such a man in my sight, carrying his trade and saddlebags, full burlap sack of tobacco and calico to barter for my compliance. Singed smell of the vinegar and smoke he uses as a screen from Indian dirt. Miami, Seneca, Shawnee, and Wyandot, headmen from each tribe are singled out in a vulture slow loop, beckoned into town to stand, silent as field stones, to greet the fearsome Modoc, a new tribe exiled from the west and punished like us onto this land that our feet still mistrust. We ride to Baxter Station, busy with city folks, ranchers, soldiers, Indian agents, gawkers. A newspaper man jots notes on a grimy fistful of paste cards. Waxy still cattle cards straddle the tracks. Deep in the corners, an arm slithers through the creosote slats. A child's dark eye meets mine through a knothole. My sorrel starts under me as I dismount. A young soldier hauls an axe and chips ineffectively at the chain that holds the cattle car doors together in a crooked embrace. The agent preens for the crowd, his starched collar growing dusky. Behold the fearsome Modoc, that chain snaking down to the ground like a panther's howl. A scattering of men, dressed in prison stripes and leather, are bound at the wrists and watered from buckets held up to their chins. The youngest soldier, red-faced, points his rifle to the ground and swallows hard. A Modoc boy holds his sister and swings his legs on the station ledge, kneecaps massive against his slender limbs. I was that child's age when I walked from Ohio to Indian Territory. 18 months with my arms rucked up around my baby sister and my eyes locked on my mama's shoulders, harried by soldiers and agents. So many times I heard them call, "If you slow us down, swear to God you are not worth bullets." After 50 years, this is what it tastes like, thistles for wheat at the root of my tongue. The Modoc boy turns his sister's chin into his tunic, covering her eyes. And I draw stairs as I haul my body up into the saddle to leave. Sometimes I need my mare under me to share the weight. Having grown old in that meager shelter of shadows cast by horses, Indian Territory, November 1873.
I'm just wondering, Laura Day, if you could tell me, have you come back to Ohio since you wrote this book? And how are you experiencing Ohio today?
I was able to briefly visit after I wrote this book, but I feel due for a long visit because I do feel that though it was painful, it was such an important piece of coming back to a homeland. So I look forward to a return. I have my fingers crossed that in the next year or two, I'll be able to come visit again. And as we're at the conclusion, the way that we say goodbye is salanoki, and that really just means, you know, we hope we'll see each other again.
Laura Day is a writer and teacher and a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. She read from her book of poems about the removal of the Shawnee tribes from Ohio in 1832. It's called Tributaries.
Coming up in episode 9, we meet Suzanne Chouteau, a Shawnee artist living in southern Ohio, who reconnected with her Shawnee heritage later in life.
My great-great-grandmothers were Shawnee, and they're in my soul, you know, they're in my makeup. And I feel, especially here, that I'm where they were, you know? They were here one time, and they were forced to leave. And so now that I've been able to return them, right? They're part of me that I've returned, my father, my grandfather. In many ways, I feel that the circle is here, you know, right here, like they came back. And I feel that, and I want to honor that.
This was episode 8 of The Ohio Country, called The Removals, written by Nina Ellis. Chris Welter interviewed Chief Billy Friend of the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma. Samantha Summer is the series editor. Dr. John Bickers is the cultural advisor. He's an assistant professor at Case Western University and a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Layla Troyer, also a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, designed our logo. Flawn Williams is the audio mixer, and the composer is Evan Miller. Thanks to public radio stations KUOW in Seattle and WGTE in Toledo. I'm the digital assets producer, Mary Evans. You can find photos and maps at wyso.org/podcast. This program is made possible through a partnership with Ohio Humanities, a nonprofit that shares stories to spark conversations and inspire ideas, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, a More Perfect Union initiative. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Ohio Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.
To see visual content related to the Ohio Country, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And for a full transcript of every episode made by humans, go to wyso.org.
Hello again. Now that you've heard this episode, let me explain again. This 12-part series was made at a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio called WYSO. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO staff and infrastructure to get the job done. So we'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.